My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's wilde.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi everyone and welcome back. This is Patricia Kathleen and I am over the moon today to be sitting down with Gianna Biscontini. She is the founder and chief behavior officer at WorkWell. And a quick bio on Gianna before I welcome her officially is she's a board certified behavioral analyst, writer, speaker, world traveler, and a passionate advocate for building a life well lived through meaningful, impactful work. Throughout her 17-year career supporting forward-thinking change makers, she has worked in healthcare, nonprofit, research, education, and government industries to improve processes and ensure top-quality operational performance. Welcome, Gianna.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you here today. You've got the fascinating, the chief behavior officer. So we're gonna. So for everyone listening, the roadmap is. We're going to get into all of Gianna's like most fascinating aspects, but we are going to cover her academic background and then kind of quick professional life after that, then her current businesses, and then questions regarding her current companies and any other projects she's working on and goals that she may have within that for the next 3 years, including scaling and changing of genre, that type of thing. And then we'll wrap up with the advice that Gianna has regarding, for those of you who are looking to get involved or follow in her path or just life lessons in general, that tends to be everyone's favorite part. Save it for the end. So let's drop right into your academic background.
Yeah, so I grew up wanting to be a pediatrician or an attorney or own a donut shop. Those were my three.
Those are all really hard choices. And the donut shop is fascinating because it frees up the last half of your day.
Yeah, it really does. And ensures I always have treats. Yeah. So I really didn't have a ton of guidance growing up. And so I kind of went into all of those things. I ended up getting a bachelor's in psychology, specifically specializing in atypical populations. So I worked with schizophrenic adults. And really was into that mental health part of the field and worked to change behavior with really difficult populations, but it was really rewarding for me. And I quickly found out the only thing you can do with a bachelor's in psych is get a master's in psych. is go to school again, which I always knew. And when I was younger, I wanted my own counseling practice, so I always knew that grad school is in my future. So I was working with children with autism for a little bit after college that I think fulfilled my need to work with children. I started out there. And before I could really get into anything, I fell in love working with children with autism. Mm-hmm. It was really fantastic. And so the gold standard for working with children with autism was to go get a BCBA credential, the Board Certified Behavior Analyst credential.
Right.
I didn't go right there. I took classes in industrial organizational psychology in Philadelphia fell in love with that too.
Industrial organizational psychology. What is that? What community is that encompassing?
It's in psychology. It's organizational development, organizational behavior, those types of things.
Right.
Working with the org charts and the people within those organizations to improve the way businesses and people operate within. So I took some of those courses, loved that as well, and actually got accepted to a clinical psych program here in California, up in Malibu at Pepperdine. But before I got accepted there, I also got accepted to an accelerated graduate program at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So I got that acceptance letter, and then I got the clinical psych acceptance letter. So I deferred my enrollment and went to school in D.C. I was living in Annapolis at the time. So I moved to D.C. and did an accelerated program there, which was two semesters and a master's degree there.
So a master's of business?
A master's in counseling culturally and linguistically diverse populations.
Nice.
I wanted to work internationally. I grew up traveling, so that was really attractive to me. So I finished that with the intention to go get the clinical psych master's, but I loved D.C. so much. I went to school four blocks from the White House.
I love D.C.
Yeah, it was amazing. And growing up, going to Europe quite a bit and coming from a European-Italian family, I loved the culture in D.C. I would walk down the street and hear four different languages, and I loved that. So I didn't end up going to get my clinical psych degree. I ended up staying at GW, and I got a full master's in education and human development. So that encompassed mostly working with children with developmental delays. And so I was kind of circling. I took the circuitous route. I was circling working with children with developmental delays and disabilities. And my plan after graduate school was to move back to California. I had spent some time in LA after college for about 8 months, just kind of driving around and getting to know California and falling in love, and always wanted to move back. But I graduated when the economy crashed. So I really had to leverage my networking in DC, and I just couldn't move out to California where no one knew me. So I ended up starting my career there. And I guess we can get into my career a little bit later, but I've continued to educate myself. I got my board certification, which actually was another couple semesters of graduate level work. Sat for my boards, got my board certified behavior analyst credential, and then picked up a credential as an organizational behavior management practitioner, and then just recently completed Stanford Graduate School of Business, their social entrepreneurship certification program.
I saw that, and I really love it. You follow a trajectory that I've seen in the past, and I think it's really crucial to kind of speak to that as well. But I saw, you know, throughout your professional history, just on paper, when I was researching your profile, that you have gone back and just kind of, you know, it's this return to any format of education, certification, degree. And I think it's important because it's the old guard, but it's amazing how much people are still kind of like, you got to go back, you know, you got to get your master's or you got to get bachelor's, then do your master's. It's this huge chunk of time that people quarantine away from their life and think, I can't work through it. Right. I couldn't possibly have a family or do anything on the side. You know, there's this idea that it's all or nothing. And while I think it is sort of changing, even the concept of keeping yourself fresh, your information constantly evolving or current with what it seems like you've done, it makes such a prolific, you know, professional, in my opinion. So what, can you speak to like what made you do that? Was it self like motivated, or did you have mentors that said, you know what you ought to do is go back and get another certification? Or was it always you just saying, that sounds great, I should go do that?
Yeah, I had no mentors. And later on in life, when I look back and realize that I didn't have mentors, I went back and I spoke to some professors and some people I knew at the time and said, you know, I never had any mentors, and I wonder if I would have been better off. And they were so surprised, and they said, you always just seemed like you knew what you were doing. And, you know, I'm so surprised, I would have loved to mentor you. I didn't even know how that works. I didn't know you ask someone to be a mentor. I thought they ask you.
Yeah.
And I've had people offer to mentor me. So I thought that's what, I was very, very just ignorant to how the whole process worked and that I could ask for help. And I think being a young female in a bustling city like DC, coming from an Italian family, and my dad was, you know, a huge entrepreneur, I just had everything to prove, and I didn't know how to ask for help or mentorship or guidance. So that's on me. But yeah, as far as education, I'm third generation Italian. My grandfather was first generation. He was all about education. And my father was all about education. So I grew up having that hammered into me, is no experience is ever wasted. And you can learn something every single day from anything that happens to you, good or bad. And so I was always seeking out that education. And I think for every piece of education that I've kind of collected, every degree I've collected, it's served a different purpose. And it's had its origins in a different region in my life. And, you know, getting a bachelor's is just kind of what you did, and that was always the expectation. Getting a master's degree was something that was just needed to do the work that I wanted to do. But I think everything after that really came to, you know, being at Stanford, I wanted to be surrounded by amazing minds doing good work in social entrepreneurship, and that's why I went. And yes, I learned the intellectual content, but I also made these 45 connections with people around the world, and we still have a WhatsApp text message where we're all supporting each other, right? So it became really about relationships and where I wanted to study and who I wanted to connect myself to and learn from. And the board certification was also a necessary thing. So you know, that's a piece of advice that I do give, is if you're gonna go back, make sure you know why and what you're gonna get out of it.
Definitely. And I also think that there's, you know, there's an intersection that doesn't just happen organically between any kind of post undergraduate work, you know, and training, even a trade school. The absolute on-the-job training happens on the job. You know, there's a disconnect between any type of even however practical theory and what you're learning in higher education and then applying it to the career. And I always try to remind myself, as well as, you know, people coming up around me, that that's for you to implement. You know, learning these kinds of dense concepts and theories, they don't do, and this is how you'll apply it in the boardroom. You know, it's much more, I mean, I think there's certain facets of like an MBA that does that, but usually it's kind of just opening up the brain to those concepts. So like what you're saying with even the contacts, that's much more part of like what you would do, you know, applicably in the real world as well. But you're going to have to take that initiative.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like the family. So you launched out of school. Break it down for me, because we walked a little bit through your academia, but you went back into DC to get, you know, the secondary part. And then how long were you involved in companies during that time, or is it solely academic work?
No, I was working and going to grad school. So I had a really rigorous schedule, which I loved. I would wake up at 6, I would work out, go for bike rides down the Potomac, and then I would have an internship from 8 until 4, and then I would go to class from 5 until 9, and then I served on the board of directors for a foundation at the time. So I would drive, you know, an hour and a half into Maryland for our nighttime meetings, and then stay up until about 2 o'clock in the morning doing work. So that was my 2 to 3 years.
And you loved it.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, I was so naturally motivated, automatically reinforced, we would say. I was naturally motivated by everything I was doing. So yeah, I think, you know, being able to actually be in school at night and then turn around and apply those concepts, you know, the next day is really important. And then when I was done with graduate school, again, the economy crashed and I had to leverage my networks for a job. So I got my dream job right out of graduate school, and it was working with, I don't know if you know of Michelle Rhee. She was the chancellor of schools in DC at the time. She was extremely controversial.
Okay.
She ended up...
It's not ringing a bell for me.
She was in... they did a movie involving her called, I think, Waiting for Superman. It was about the DC school system.
Okay.
Essentially, she fired a bunch of teachers that were underperforming and used that money to build, in part, a $10 million evaluation center that I ended up working in. So there was a... lawsuit in DC where a child had been found to have developmental delays early on in life. Long story short, file got lost and nothing was ever done to help this child. So this lawsuit was kind of leveraged to improve the services in DC and find those high-risk kids and essentially evaluate every 3 to 5 year old in the district. And so that's what we did. We had a child find team. They would go out into the fields, into nursery schools, into homes, evaluate kids, flag them, and I ran one of the evaluation teams. So at 26 years old, I was leading people that were 10 to 15 years older than me, running this evaluation team of a psychologist, a speech pathologist, an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, and myself. And we would all do our one-way mirror style evaluations on these 3 to 5 year olds, draw up a plan for them, and then find the best placement for them in the school district. So that's really where I got to do the work with children, but also it was a startup within the government, which almost never happens.
I was just gonna say, that's so rare.
It was so rare and it was crazy. And you know, they kind of, they brought us in and they said, you know, you're the people in DC that are gonna change this. And they aligned us to a purpose so quickly. And it was the best leadership I ever worked under. Our executive director and our director were amazing. They were empowering. And we were really building the airplane as we were flying it. And that was my jam. A lot of people don't like that, but I really live off that sink or swim ambiguity type of environment, which I didn't know at the time, but it was a startup environment. Mm-hmm. And if there wasn't a document, if there wasn't a form, if there wasn't a process, I created it. So what I was doing right off the bat was what I now do, organizational behavior management, is using the science of human behavior within the workplace to improve those processes. So we really all helped build that department and that company from the ground up over the first couple years. And I had noticed that you know, my background was with children with autism. Children with autism would come in and they, you know, would be 4 years old and they haven't said a word yet, but their parents either didn't have the education or didn't have the background to know that that is a huge red flag. So we would have to send them home and it would take 4 other weeks for a psychologist to come back in and do the autism assessment. And we were on a timeline. We were on a 40-day timeline, so we could not afford to move slowly. So I created an extra department and it was specifically a pipeline for children with autism. We used all kinds of assessment and diagnostic tools with the Child Find team. So they got a straight pipeline to the autism team that I was running there.
That so kind really, of quick problem solving is so rewarding.
It's really rewarding. And having the space to do it. You know, now, mm-hmm. you know, the work that I see now and the climate and the culture that I see now, unfortunately, doesn't give a ton of autonomy and doesn't have, they don't have the supports in place to say, I've got an idea. Great, go do it. And I worked with the top educational attorneys in DC and I got things thrown at me in meetings. I got screamed at. I got, you know, every lawyer's trick in the book thrown in my way at 26 years old because we're leading these meetings, you know, saying this is what we're going to provide to the child. The attorney would say that's unacceptable, but they had no backgrounds, you know, in education or with children. So it was always kind of going back and forth. And I remember running into my executive director's office and saying, I'm going up against the top educational attorney right now. You know, this is what we're offering. This is what they want. This is inappropriate. What do I do? And he was always so calm. He'd say, what do you think you should do? He never gave me any answers. And I would say, well, this is what I think we should do. He'd be great. Go do it.
Yeah.
And just say, yep, go do it. Come in if you need me. And it was so empowering that at such a young age, my first job out of grad school, where I'm really trying to make a difference, and we work right outside the Capitol building and this symbol of purpose and integrity, it really fostered that within me from the beginning. And so I'm really lucky that even though I've worked for good and not so great companies since then, that was my foundation.
At first blush, for sure. And having that supervisor be, you know, both male and supportive, I mean, wildly rare.
Wildly
the
rare.
The people that I run up to, you know, again, against in my past 20 years, that's a very awesome experience to come out of your professional life that way, especially to, you know, judge things against both positive and negative after they come after that. Yeah. So you did that, and what prompted you to leave that dream job?
It's the government still. So while I had a lot of autonomy and I had the best leadership and they empowered me beyond belief, but it's still the government and big things move slowly. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was a little thing who moved very quickly. And our director was a female, our executive director was a male, both supportive. And the female director had said, you know, you're a lot like me and I understand why you're leaving. You know, come back if you like, you've done a lot here. And essentially within the first month, I had set out to develop this autism specific team. It took me 2 years to do it, where it really could have taken about 4 or 5 months. So I put everything I had into it. And the day the team was led independent, and I felt good leaving, I handed it off to the psychologist that I had spoken to about running it prior to that. And I left to go find my next big thing. And I did a complete 180 and ran a photography company for a year and a half.
Amazing. Yeah. And what bumped you into that? What kind of like wild moment walking down a street where you're like, you know what, I'm gonna go run a photography studio?
Yeah, I was an amateur photographer for a while. Mm-hmm. And I had friends that would, you know, comment and start to hire me for things. And I was asked to do weddings. And I had a friend in PR who, I had a lot of PR friends in DC who had high visibility and who ran events and all that. So they said, you know, you should be a photographer. And while you're at it, you should start your own company and we'll hire you and you've already got clients. So it was one of those things where it feels the good kind of scary.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I don't know if I can do this. And I've always run into that burning building to see if I could, if
right.
I could make it happen.
Yeah.
And I did. And I had amazing experiences and awesome clients. And I always grew up, even as a child, with this bipolarity of I was prima ballerina and piano lessons and horseback riding lessons. And then at age 10, everything flipped and I got really into sports. Mm-hmm. So it was always like the creative and the science and, you know, the girly, but also like the really sciencey, hardworking. So I've always had that bipolarity. And I've, since I was young, I always told myself that I'd have to choose one avenue over another, either going to do, you know, creative work and be a photographer and travel and do fashion stuff, or you're going to become a scientist and you're going to become an academic. Mm. And I've never had, I can't remember a time where I've done both at once, but I've never had to give up either one of those things. So it was nice to be in that creative space for a year and a half, 2 years, mm-hmm. Until I kind of figured out the next move back into academia.
And that's what drew you back, going back into academia. And that drew you back out west, or did you stay?
I was in DC, and after about a year and a half, 2 years with photography, I thought, okay, you know, I'm ready to go back. To mm-hmm. The pendulum swung in the other direction.
Yeah.
And said, okay, I'm ready to use the other side of my brain now. And I knew I would have to go back to get a board certification in behavior analysis. That's really what I wanted to do if I wanted to keep working with children with autism. And
did you know what realm? Because you had done government. Did you know you didn't want to do government?
I knew I didn't want to do government.
Private
yeah.
sector.
I really learned that I loved running teams. Mm-hmm. I was really good. We had the most effective team out of 10, and we were super high performing, and I loved leading that team and working with people who are older than me and just seeing myself as a guide. And I learned a lot about leadership, again, from my leaders there. So I became really interested in leadership, really interested in developing teams and businesses. But I also knew that I had this skill set to work with children with autism. So I wanted to work my way up there and then have, you know, either my own practice or do research or something one day. Wasn't super clear on the details. I knew I wanted to get back and get my board certification because that would allow me to do a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, from photography, I went back to working with children with autism, went to school in Virginia, so I'd have to take the train about an hour into Virginia and then
the commute,
the shuttle, about 30 minutes.
Did you read?
And then
I
walk
don't know.
Around.
No.
Yeah. And then walk to my building. So it took me about 2 hours to get into the depths of Virginia because there still aren't that many behavior analysis programs. And 10 years ago, there were even less. So I was lucky that I had anything with even, you know, within proximity to me, let alone, I could have done online, but I was a more in-person type of girl. So yeah, I did that. I had always wanted to move back to California. And when I was in my behavior analysis certification program at George Mason, the Senate bill got passed to say that medical insurance would now cover ABA therapy, which is the gold standard for children with autism. So my job market blew up. And I had the option to move anywhere in the country and took the opportunity to finally move back to California. I was in the middle of my program. They gave me the option to do the online version. I said, no, I want the interaction. So they Skyped me in on a wall on California time.
Just doing your own thing, creating your own little path there.
Yep, creating
Skype
my own little
path.
Skype
me in, guys.
Skyping into class, and I would just sit there on a giant screen as like the odd student in the classroom. And yeah, so I took a job with a large nonprofit out here in San Diego and climbed the ladder to leadership really quickly and did that for about 4.5 years. Running teams and doing behavior analysis with children with autism.
For the nonprofit.
For the nonprofit.
And then what had you pivot out of that?
I had gone as far as I could go. And I saw that, you know, behavior analysis isn't just for children with autism. I had unknowingly used it in the government, working with, you know, fully functioning adults. Mm-hmm. You can use it in consumer behavior. You can use it anywhere. It's a science of human behavior. It tells us why we do what we do, and it helps us change sustainably and measurably and objectively. And it was just such an amazing experience getting this board certification and understanding behavior, because once you see it and understand it, you can't unsee it. It's everywhere, and it's so powerful. It's the best way that there is to change behavior for the positive, and to change businesses and to improve anything that involves behavior, which is, you know, from training dogs to working with geriatric populations to children to adults and businesses. So I worked as far as I could in the business. I got married March 2017. I resigned in May 2017. And then I lived in Europe for a month and left and walked around Europe and was so, I thought I was gonna start my own behavioral pediatrics practice and just kind of do things my own way.
In Europe, or just hanging out in Europe
here
to figure that one out?
Yeah, just going to Europe. It was on a bucket list of mine.
Yeah.
I always promised myself that when I transitioned jobs, if I could, I would take, you know, a month to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I knew this was the only time. I had a friend who got a giant severance package and got laid off from a job she was trying to leave anyway. So she
Buddy.
Was super happy. Yeah, and we grew up together. I've known her since the day I was born. So we took off to Europe together.
Nice.
And I thought I would come back and start my own behavioral pediatrics clinic. And when I was in Europe, I really recalibrated and really grounded down, and without anyone else around me, without my professional networks, without mm-hmm. parents and, you know, other influences, I really got to dial down to what I really wanted to do. And I knew it wasn't behavioral pediatrics, but I didn't listen. And I came back refreshed and excited, and I developed my pediatric practice over 2 months. And I was sitting there one day at my office, and I thought, why am I doing this? Yeah, I left the
shortly
field to
after
do something
getting
different.
It completely launched. 2 months in. That's yep. right about when you've done all the admin, the yucky stuff.
Yep, taking on clients, all of that, going to work
awesome.
With pediatricians and
yeah.
building those referrals. And I thought, yeah. whoa, if I have the opportunity to use behavioral science and to use behavior analysis anywhere to solve any problem, there are already people out there like me working with children, right? There are more than enough of us to go around. I had the opportunity to create a niche for myself and to create anything. It was this world of possibility that I hadn't had in a really long time. And so I took some time and I started researching meditation. I was reading neuroscience. I was reading public health. And I did a values assessment on myself. I did all of this work on myself. October 2017, and started writing about meditation. And I wrote an article calling meditation behavioral Xanax, and sent
nice.
It out to my field. And I will never forget sitting at my kitchen table. It was actually September 2017. And I had written this article on why behavior analysts should study meditation, which is very taboo. Mindfulness and everything having to do with the mind and feelings and thoughts isn't widely discussed or studied in our field, unfortunately, although that's changing. And my husband was like, what's the big deal? Just submit the article. You know, you were asked to write it and invited to this magazine to write for them. And I said, this could end my career. This mm-hmm. could make a fool out of me. And this could dislodge everything I'm trying to do before it even gets started. And I did it anyway. And I got emails from around the world. thanking me and encouraging me and asking me questions and wanting to get on board and wanting to know what I was doing next. And I had just tapped into this kind of underground feeling, this underground kind of energy with our field of like, I want to help people outside of the world of autism and outside of what we're doing, and I want to help grow our field. We're a predominantly female field, and sometimes I feel like we don't have the permission to color outside the lines.
Right.
And I had unknowingly, by writing this article, tapped into people that wanted to color outside the lines, but didn't feel like they had permission. So it worked out really well. I started creating behavioral Xanax courses and meditation.
I love that.
And all of
so
that.
So you did use the behavioral Xanax, the actual term. You didn't infer it. It was like, that was it.
That is the name of our course. We've done a bunch of reiterations, and I've taken on other people to help out with that. And when I was creating one of the courses, I was reading a lot of neuroscience and public health research on just what's being done with meditation. And I realized that was my mic drop, boom, this is everything moment of the workplace is such a stressor. And it's been normalized. So that's dangerous, right?
Right. It's been heralded.
Exactly.
I mean, it's almost this kind of mystique of this ultra, you know, with the launch of Mad Men, you know, this even, it's been going on since the 50s, you know, this crazy, insane universe where it's called work and everyone's stressed.
Yeah.
It's like this proud badge almost, you know, not even just accepted, I would say. People talk about how stressful their job is this kind of like, I endured this marathon.
Oh, it's an award, it's social currency. Mm-hmm. And I see that, oh gosh, I worked 11 hours yesterday. Oh, I worked 12, oh, I worked 13, and I have 4 kids. And it's just this constant, who can burn themselves out more and who can, it's martyrdom. I mean, I think we all do it.
It is martyrdom.
We all do it, and because we all want to feel needed, right? Oh, I can't take vacation because I'm so needed at work.
That's so crucial.
I did a video on that. It's like on one of our video series where I talk about you are and should never be so important to your company that you cannot leave for 2 weeks. That's an organizational fault. That's an organizational issue. So I thought, wow, this is a public health concern, is the amount of stress derived from the workplace. And as someone who goes in to assess and modify environments and the behavior to influence that behavior, that was my problem. That was my problem that I was going to solve. It found me in Europe. With the, you know, everything is closed from 2 to 4 or 3 to 5 and everybody takes siestas, and it's, you know, that way of life, they're everything. I think when your purpose finds you and you find it, it's just kind of this washing machine tumbling of, you can kind of see how everything up to that point has led you there.
Right.
And I'm so grateful that I had that moment. So I developed Workwell the end of 2017 in December. I knew it was going to be a big project. I took on partners. Mm-hmm. And we've been, you know, moving forward ever since.
How did you find your partners, and what's the website address?
Oh, so funny. So when I started talking about meditation, I had Biscontini Behavior, which was my pediatrics company, and I started talking about meditation, and people were finding me on social media and saying, I care about health and well-being. I want to use behavior analysis there. So I leveraged social media. And I put it out there, and I said, I'm looking to take on some help. And I probably got 50 inquiries and narrowed it down to about 2 dozen people and conducted interviews. Our field is really small. I knew I wanted to hire other behavior analysts. Mm-hmm. Our field is extremely small, so it didn't take too much time.
Which platform, to find those people. Can I ask, like Facebook? Pinterest,
Instagram, mostly.
You're the second person I've spoken to that's had great success there.
Yeah, mostly we work on LinkedIn now. Instagram, our data, you know, shows us that our followers are younger females. So I know a lot of people in my field of behavior analysis are just purely interested in Workwell. So we do keep up a fun visual. That's where I get to use like the creative part of me, the visually engaging, fun videos. So it's kind of silly and not very serious, and it's fun. But we mostly work on LinkedIn now because I work with C-suite leaders and HR professionals and all that. So that's our tied up professional
When you were vetting the crew that you were bringing on as kind of being this team that you were going to work with, did you have to consider, you must have had to consider, but how did it, you know, you can get along with someone and think, I'll work well with you, but then you've got other players. Like, everyone needs to kind of, especially in the marriage of, you know, founding a company and running one together, it's a delicate dance. Two people is hard, but you've got three or four.
Yes, and we've had a couple. So we, I brought people on and gave them equity right away. Mm-hmm. And I had a conversation. I said, you know, they were all in California at the time, and California labor law would not allow me to hire them as consultants. And they came on board because they were interested in learning from me. And hiring them as consultants wouldn't have allowed me to guide them or develop them in any way. Mm-hmm. So that just wasn't going to work. And be mutually beneficial for everyone. So I said, I find trust to be the cornerstone of everything, especially business. We're starting a new business, and I want to start out with a gesture of trust. And that's our main focus here, is we're always going to come back to trust. So how do you feel about being my business partners for an equity share? And they were kind of blown away and caught off guard. Yeah. And I said, you know, you don't need to buy into the company. You don't need to, you know, I'll handle all that stuff. And we drew up a partnership agreement that was mutually beneficial for everyone. So I could grow and develop the team. They could add to what we're doing and grow, you know, in the field that we're building. We have no competitors. We have no anyone that's so doing what we're doing. So it's been an exciting time, and taking on those partners has been one of the most fulfilling parts of it.
So on your website, I grabbed a tag. It says, we help human-centered companies design workplaces that improve retention, performance, and quality of life through employee well-being. Mm-hmm. That is, it's a lot packed in there.
Yeah.
You know, if you analyze the systems that make that statement come to be, there is a lot going on. Like, my head begins to swim at the analysis. So my first question regarding this statement, and then kind of unpacking a little bit about how you came to design and how you uniquely redesigned for every client you have, is, do you, with dealing with behavioral analysis, when you approach a business, do you deal with the business as its own separate entity, with other entities being employees and founders underneath it? Or is the business made up of all of those constituents? Like, what's your model when you look at it?
Yeah, so we take that behavior analytic approach, and it's systematic, and it's all based and rooted in science. So groups don't behave, and organizations don't behave.
Right.
People do. So that's where we start. Our starting point, and I'm sorry, you asked about the website. It's WorkWell, W3RK, W-E-L-L, and the three symbolizes the intersection between business behavior and health. And that's why our logo is that triangle, because that's really where we live. So in that spirit of business behavior and health, we researched dozens and dozens of articles, business articles, health research, behavior analytic research, and we came up with our health and business assessment. So when we talk about employee well-being and organizational health and corporate wellness and whatever buzzwords are out there, we hear the words culture and engagement and loving what you do and all of that. But if we're going to change anything, it involves behavior. So coming in, we assess the employees first, and that is the only touch point we have with the actual employees. A lot of corporate wellness programs or other change systems will take the employees and develop them or teach them things individually, how to communicate, how to deal with stress. But at the end of the day, the environment really shapes our behavior. So Number one, you know, we didn't want to place the burden of well-being solely on the shoulders of the employee. So we do source them with our health and business assessment. It takes 20 to 25 minutes. We try and make it as fun and as engaging as possible. And they're like little pineapples that pop up. And just, we did our best to make it fun. Mm-hmm. But we evaluate attention and focus, performance and growth, and leadership. Those are the three buckets. Because at the end of the day, what you weigh or how often you exercise or what you eat is really a result of the stressful contingencies that you're under and your stress responses. So I can wake up and run a 5K every morning and have my green juice, but if I go into an environment that's an aversive, you know, stressful place,
right.
I sit in a stress response for 8 to 10 hours a day. And I likely come home, remained in that stress response. So we didn't want employees to have anything else crammed into their schedule. And at the end of the day, it's really up to leadership, to HR and those C-suite executives to say, let's change the way our workplace operates. And wouldn't it be better to do that so that the workplace wasn't a stressful environment? So that you are more available, you do have more energy, you're happier, you're more engaged, and all of that. And when we talk about, you know, what is culture and what is engagement, nobody really ever knows what that means.
Uh-huh, right.
And when I say, you know, how do you define culture? The first word out of anyone's mouth is I or we. I think it's this, we define it as that. The problem with that is you can't change or measure what you can't define. Mm-hmm. And if we don't know what contributes to culture, we don't know how to measure or to change it. So you end up throwing this really expensive spaghetti over the wall and hoping it sticks, and there's no pre or post measurement. So yeah. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars are being spent when we're not really sure what the purpose is or what we're hoping to get out of it, and we don't measure before or after. So we do that health and business assessment. We source the employees for information. Most of the assessment items are directly observable, so I can actually take the results, cross-analyze them by role and how long you've been there and all of that, and then we actually verify the results. These things are either present or absent in the workplace. So we can actually go in and make it really, really sensitive and robust as a measure. Then we write a report and recommendations and offer services from there. We do executive workshops. We do small to large, full-scale projects dependent on what your priorities are and what shows up in the health and business assessment. And then we also ask, are you interested or do you have plans to take someone from your company and create an in-house position to keep all of this progress going?
Mm-hmm.
And some companies say yes and some companies say no. We do offer to do training on behavior science and how
training
to take data.
Training up someone that you find, do you source the person or do they assign someone within, or is it kind of optional?
It's optional. That's mm-hmm. just something that we throw on the table to say, hey, you know, we don't have to be here every single day. We don't want to have to come back every single month or every single year. I haven't done my job and my consultants haven't done their job if we have to keep coming back. Behavior does drift, right? January, everybody's at the gym. April, you're eating pizza for breakfast.
Right. Right.
So we want to teach people not only to come in and change and then say, bye, see you later after 3 months. We want to make sure that our change is sustainable.
Yeah.
So that we build that within so the company can sustain its people over time, because behavior runs your business. And if you don't have someone on staff that understands truly how to measure and change and define behavior, that drift, whoever you bring in, whether it's us or another consulting company, that drift is going to occur and you don't get that optimal ROI.
Who are your clients? Are they stressed out? Are they at a breaking point, or are they just people looking to improve? Like, at what point do people, I imagine it's a moment of distress. It's a feeling of, I don't know, a lawsuit maybe, or, you know, it's some point of someone's coming to recognition that their company is not as fluid as it should be.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've seen both ends of the spectrum. The last assessment, the last project we took on was with a B Corp certified nonprofit in Brazil. And they had the highest scores that we've ever had on our health and business assessment. So they're already doing so much right, and they're already doing many things well.
They wanted to do better.
Right. And they were curious of, oh, you know, employee well-being, it's not just apples in the break room, or, you know, putting a Fitbit on someone and you know, yeah. aligning their insurance costs to that. Like, that's ridiculous.
Right.
People are like, it's like house arrest. So, you know, I was explaining to one of their executives how we see behavior and how we see well-being. And he got it immediately and said, we want to work with you. I'm super curious to see where else we can be better. And it's amazing that you're measuring well-being by leadership and performance and growth and attention and focus and those types of things that do lead to that harmful stress, which leads to those stress behaviors, whether it's resignation, sabotaging the company, unethical behavior, whatever, just not producing at your highest. We also have companies in healthcare. I just spoke with a pharmaceutical company the other day who is struggling, although they just hit a huge milestone within their company. So they want to work. I talked to them before this, And I said, let's use this behavioral momentum, right? Let's build this behavioral momentum. You've got this great piece of news as you hit this milestone and you're coming back and you're moving forward. Now's the perfect time to bring WorkWell in, and we'll do, you know, series of, you know, workshops or a full-scale project or whatever the assessment results show. So we see, yes, struggling and already doing very well and everything in between.
Is it unique? Do you design? I mean, it sounds like you have some kind of standards across the board that you're coming in, these assessments and things like that, but is, and then your suggestions, you know, at the end of the analysis, but is this, is every company taken on unique terms? Because it feels like the amount of employees, like there's so many boutique situations that feel like it would change the dynamics from what you can do to the larger scale companies. Mm-hmm. Does it change? Do you guys adjust for every different profile? And I feel like even industry would kind of affect how you came at it.
So behavior is behavior is behavior. Okay. And as long as you understand the behavioral contingencies that exist in a certain environment, you can work with that. So we do target healthcare, bioscience, you know, life sciences, and technology companies because they already have the understanding of the science. When I say, hey, there's a science to human behavior, they're like, right, got it, let's work together. Yeah. Whereas other industries, smart, it takes a little bit longer. So yeah. We don't need to do as much marketing and explaining because they already get the science and they love the scientific approach that we take. When you're a behavior analyst, you're really highly trained to go into a new environment and see everything. Our tools, yes, we have assessments. Our tools are our ears and our eyes. Everything that we base our decisions off of is measured on data. It's not subjective opinion. I'm not going to go in and say, oh, this leader doesn't sound like a very good listener. I'm going to do a communication or a listening workshop and teach them active listening. Right. That can be a part of it. I would much rather follow a leader around like I have done and say, hey, you know, of the 10 hours I've spent with you, whenever your managers ask you questions, you only give an on-topic response about 30% of the time. That might contribute to why you're getting this feedback that you don't listen. Because at the end of the day, now you can take that, right? And say, oh, yeah. So when I'm asked a question, now that's a cue for my behavior to say, answer this question.
And it's true across all genres.
Right. And you can really apply that anywhere.
So with your company, well, first of all, we didn't touch on when did you officially launch?
We officially launched January of 2018.
WorkWell did?
Yes.
Okay. So pretty new?
Pretty new.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
That's kind of your favorite spot, right? The very beginning,
yes.
Bootstrap, get going.
Yeah.
Do you guys have, I'm sure, a business plan's in place, but this, I like more of the ethereal business plan. You have the business plan on paper, you know, mm-hmm. the one that you give in your elevator pitch and things like that. But like, what is your more idealistic, like 3 to 5 years? Like, have you gone that far in your manifestations?
Absolutely. I have a couple goals for WorkWell. One of them is to obviously influence the way that companies work. We want to build a certification program that is high quality, measurable, and extremely coveted. And when we see ourselves as well-being strategists now, right? You wouldn't wait until your business is failing to build a business strategy or a business plan. Why would you wait until your people are failing to build, you know, a people strategy, a well-being strategy? Yeah. And that all involves behavior and modifications to the environment that need to be measured. So we want to build a WorkWell certification program that will help not only preserve the workforce and improve the workforce that already exists, but in this time of low unemployment, companies really have to be competitive, right? So we want to create something that companies can say, we're a great company, we are a WorkWell certified company, our employees are preserved, they have lives outside of the company, and they can use that to attract that high quality talent to continue adding to their, you know, amazing, productive, high quality culture that they're building.
Yeah.
That's our goal number one.
The certification program.
Yeah, the certification program. It's huge, yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of other, I guess, certification programs out there that have lost meaning. We evaluated a company with a a very popular certification, and they didn't do that well on our health and business assessment. We really take a completely niche, kind of unique approach to find those variables that aren't typically assessed. And we don't use a 360, we don't use a DISC, we don't use personality tests. Those are all really subjective. So we wanna make sure that, you know, with the certification program, it's very well done and it's very clear as to what makes this company a work well certified company, and that my consultants can come in and just do checks, you know, every 6 months or every year, depending on the size of the company, to say, great, we've got your measurements here, we've got the data, everything looks good, and everybody's clear. I think a lot of businesses operate off of ambiguity, which leaves a lot open to interpretation, and it really does thwart that progress and goals.
It makes my chest tighten when you say that. I'm like, no, don't say that. It's true, you know, and it's what makes me like hyperventilate. I think what's cool about developing a certification process too is that you have such a tight relationship with the measures that you use when you analyze, and being able to, it kind of touches back into that freedom you really enjoyed in your first job, where, you know, you were developing programs, because you get to take measures you find valid and kind of discard aspects of or entire measures that you think aren't valid, you know, mm-hmm. creating this unique. And then what I love about that, the opportunity to re-educate clients out there, like, this is why we're developed the way we are, and question anyone else, you know, and what they're doing. Like, why are they following that? Like, why are you giving your employees a personality test? Like, you don't need to know that Judy loves to draw. You know,
right.
It's like, there's like certain things that it's like, we're just collecting data, and personality tests became so big in the aughts. Everyone was taking one, you know, for their employer and loving it and talking about the results and things. And I thought that that was dandy, but I wasn't sure about how it was relating back to the fact that they were still working 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
So a lot of those things. And I like the idea of the certification. It sounds arduous for me personally. It sounds like a nightmare, but doing it, I think it's like guru status. You already have, you're so ingrained, it sounds like, with the systems that you're following, but developing that certification gives you an opportunity also to educate, right? Which you're already doing with your clients, but the industry at large.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want to move things forward, right? The HR people I talk to and the leaders I talk to, most of them will now say, oh, the Myers-Briggs is really outdated, or you're right, we're not really sure how to use the DISC, right? People will say, well, I'm Blue, you know, from the DISC, but we don't introduce each other to say, hi, I'm Gianna, I'm Blue, right? And then now you have to effortfully think about, well, what does that mean, and all of that. And at the end of the day, even like with introversion and extroversion, our environments really shape who we are. You know, we're different at work than we are at happy hour with our friends, than we are with our kids, than we are when we're surfing. You know, our environments really set the stage for what's acceptable and not acceptable. And that's how we define culture. It's a process of behaviors that are reinforced and punished in any given environment. And that creates that culture. And I love talking to people about that on a deeper level. And then they get it. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, we really, it's not a hard sell, at least with the clients that we work with and the people that we talk to. And yes, the certification program is a giant project, but it's aligned to such a strong purpose of educating people about what is effective. This is not, it has nothing to do with me. It's not, you know, Biscantini behavior analysis. I didn't come up with any of this, right? It's a science.
Yeah.
And if we can normalize that and share it with people and make it, you know, it's not scary. It's not this like esoteric, ephemeral, like, oh, only scientists can do it. It's everywhere, and it's responsible for everything that we do. So if we can share that and teach HR people and teach leaders about how, you know, behaviors are developed in the workplace, and how a person goes from a high performer to what happened to Sally, she hasn't performed, and what's going on, or vice versa. That's probably our biggest paycheck, is bringing that understanding to people and helping them create those new environments in a really effective, sustainable way.
Will it take you the 3 to 5, or will you have it implemented in the 3 to 5 years?
We'll have it implemented before that. I've got a lot of side projects going on, and a couple of those have just ended. So we've got time to work on that now. Now it's really just execution and us getting out there and working with clients and developing the business that way. But we have the intellectual space now to think about what does this look like, and let's map this out. Mm-hmm. And can we automate it? You know, working with people up in Silicon Valley and tech investors and all of that, and having access to those people has been really useful for me. It's all in the works. I have a feeling it'll it'll move quickly.
In the next 3 to 5. That's exciting. It's a big endeavor. People usually say, you know, to start doing like casual Friday. That's what we're going to start doing in the next 3 to 5. I'm just kidding. Entrepreneurs usually have larger scales, but a certification program is right up there. So let's say you bump into someone, a young female professional in the field, and she thinks that she's going to get into, you know, behavioral analysis. She's looking at the workforce. She's kind of all, you know, got a bunch of different areas that she's looking at. What would you advise her, the top three things that you would say, here's what you want to look at? She's got her degrees. She's got some certification. What would be your top three pieces of advice for her?
My first piece of advice would be to sit down and think about who you are, mm-hmm. and what you enjoy doing and what your values are and why you enjoy doing what you enjoy doing. I can actually launch this now. We are starting a podcast and an organization. A colleague of mine, Shannon Biagi, and I would get dozens of emails between us a month with just the situation you described. Mm-hmm. I'm a BCBA, I like your work. You know, Shannon gets asked, you know, technical questions. I get asked the more like visionary, like I wanna be a leader, start my own company questions. So we actually are launching next month our own podcast and a mentorship program for these women called B&B.
B&B?
Yeah.
Nice.
I think the website's bbhive.live. Yes, I think that just went, I think we just launched today. So now I have a place to direct these women to. Yeah. So I would say go there because we Absolutely. Do mentorship and coaching now. But most of the time, you know, I would spend an hour with each one of these women that would reach out to me and ask me these questions. And as I would say, okay, well, what's your business idea? Well, I don't know. And it turned out it wasn't that they knew what they wanted to do. It was that all they knew was that they didn't want to do what they were doing at that moment. Mm. And the only advice I can give someone in that position is go spend some time on yourself and think about who you are and write a vision statement, write a mission statement. What problem do you want to solve? I mean, really have that direction. And you have to build your own compass because only you can do that work. I'm happy to tell you what's out there and to tell you my story and Shannon's story, you know, happy to tell you her story. But at the end of the day, build your own story and give yourself that permission to commit to, even if you can't leave your job where you are right now, commit to taking one step out of that box and write about it or think about it or do both. And then find Shannon and I, go to find B&B or reach out to me at Workwell and we can guide you from there. But at the end of the day, you know, we want to help build a generation of women who don't wait for permission. Mm-hmm. And who don't sit around saying, I'm this great, talented person, do something with me. Tell me what to do, tell me where to go. I would much rather do what my first bosses did, male and female, who empowered me to say, what do you want? And what do you think is right? And mm-hmm. what do you want to do? And, oh, okay, you want to create an autism, you know, department. Write it out. What does it look like? And they would push all the work back to me instead of, you know, taking it and doing it themselves, and they would push it back to me, and it forced me to grow, and it forced me to develop as a female.
Clarity, right?
Clarity,
having
absolutely.
Clarity about and, exactly and what you're doing. And
exactly, and confidence, and also being comfortable and okay with not having that clarity yet. I think it's extremely stressful. It's like, I don't know what I want to do. I just want to do something else, yeah. And you just want to move forward. And then you get idea drunk, right? And I've been there, idea drunk. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to do this. And every person that you meet and everything that you learn, especially when you work in behavioral science, because you can work anywhere. You can work on anything. So really becoming clear on that and saying yes and taking those low risks right away and getting out there and doing it. So my first would be find clarity or be okay if you don't have the clarity yet. Step two would be go do something, anything. Take a step in any direction. Hopefully you have somewhat of a direction to move in that's forward. It's not gonna be the direction that you're moving in a month, probably not the direction you're moving in a week. But if you start to take those first steps, you build that fluency in those behaviors of doing things yourself and giving yourself that permission and approaching towards a vision. Sometimes the best examples are non-examples. Who do I not want to work for? Where do I not want to work? What problems don't I care about? What problems don't I really want to solve? So yeah, it's finding that clarity and then and creating some action to build that confidence. And then three, I would say, is to find someone who's doing something along the lines of what you're thinking, whether they're inspiring to you or they've got a great story. Come up with three questions and schedule, ask for 15 to 30 minutes of their time. Mm-hmm. Cause we're all super busy. And when I talk to people, I like when people have those questions in mind, right? Because it's very reinforcing for me to say, great questions, here's what you do, and I can connect you to someone that can help you do that, or here's what I did. But yeah, I think those two steps are critical first, because otherwise you're gonna burn that one phone call that you have with that person that you look up to, right? And it's kind of a, well, tell me about yourself. And it's just like this really open, awkward conversation, as opposed to, here's my problem I wanna solve, this is what I need from you, and just ask for it. And anybody that you look up to is likely gonna be able to point you in a direction. You're gonna get a lot more out of that phone call and out of that relationship than if you just kind of arbitrarily wanna hear a good story.
Absolutely. So clarity, momentum, and mentorship or advice.
Yeah.
Those top three. Those are awesome. Those are like the top three pillars of life for me. I completely agree. I'm a big believer in momentum. I'm a big believer in running with any lead, no matter how small, you know, and following it through to its death or fruition. And
absolutely.
So, and then the mentorship thing too. I come from a school where, you know, there's always, I'm an incredibly aggressive woman, but I always have, even with my bravado, I have in the back of my head, oh, they're gonna be so busy. And so I always tell people, just start with like, we're all super busy. It's gonna take 5 minutes. You know, there's that moment, because I think that you do need to kind of defer to someone's schedule and pay homage to, you know, the God of busyness. And then also, the busiest, most important women I have met with this year are the first to give me time, period. You know, and there's an old adage that says, you know, if you want something done, ask the busiest person you know, because they're getting it done, you know. And it seems counterintuitive, but it's played out so many times in my life. And so I always tell people, you know, the more powerful the person, frequently, the more likely that they're gonna give you 5 minutes if you can be very, like you're saying, clear, motivated, and, you know, precise about what you just want to briefly speak about.
Absolutely, and behavior is bidirectional, right? So, you know, if I call someone and I ask them these very specific questions, and I'm driven and I'm hungry and I know my purpose, it's very rewarding for the person on the other end of that phone to give me advice, because they know I'm gonna go do something with it, and I'm not stealing their time, or I'm not just wanting to hear a cool story for 5 minutes of inspiration. I'm saying, I've pinpointed you, I look up to you, I've read this work that you know did, or I saw this work that you did. Here are my questions, could I have 15 minutes of your time?
Right.
It's so rewarding. And if you find someone that you admire, who's doing well, they probably have already been through that process of finding that clarity and finding that purpose, and they're gonna love giving back to you. And that's how relationships are built, right? That's how those bi-directional, mutually beneficial relationships are built. And then you can go back to that person, because it was so rewarding for them to talk to you the first time. And you can come back and say, I did everything you told me to. Thank you so much. This was what has happened as a result of it. That's all you. Thank you for guiding me that direction. I have one more question. Or what do you think about this? And then you have this relationship, and it's good for everyone.
Yeah, it is.
And that's always a beautiful thing.
It does. It feeds both sides, all systems involved. I agree with that. We're gonna wrap up today. I always ask people, we're Friday. Let's say this weekend. Thursday. This is Thursday. I live in Friday. Friday is my home. What are you most looking forward to doing this weekend with your time?
I am going down to our house in Baja and playing with my puppy and hanging out with my husband. I will be writing an outline for my next book. I just wrapped up my last book last week.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I'll be mapping out my next book. And just having some relaxing time to write and be on the ocean, drink good wine, good food,
yes,
do some yoga on the deck.
Yeah, that sounds like a dream. I'm coming.
You can come.
Yeah, it's a big house. Absolutely. Well, I want to say thank you so much, Gianna, for meeting with me today. It was awesome.
Thank you.
I really
you.
Appreciate all of
thank
your
you
insight.
So much.
If people want to contact you one more time, your web address?
Web address is workwell, W3RKWELL.com. And our email address is sayhello@workwell.com.
Cool. And then the new podcast series, tentatively, the...
It's bbhive.live. And it's B&B, Biscontini and Biagi. Our website is up. You can subscribe. So you can subscribe to be a part of those monthly meetings. We'll be taking an hour to answer questions directly from people who subscribe to our organization. And then the podcast, they'll have free access to that. The podcast will be free and live. We'll start recording at the end of the month, so that should be out in September.
I can't wait to listen to it. I'll be one of your first listeners.
Thank you. Yeah, follow us on our social media channels. We'll launch it, and you'll see it come through somehow.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for meeting with me.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
Everyone, thank you for listening, and until we speak next time, remember to always bet on yourself. Slunching.